I think we should be looking for 20 to 25 minutes.
Okay, that sounds good.
I think that should be our target.
Yep.
And maybe we should record a little thing at some point that says, welcome back to the podcast.
Yes. Well, perhaps we're doing it now.
Maybe we are.
Yeah.
I think we should do that separately.
Okay.
But this is essentially number one, isn't it, on the
list.
What do they call it in trendy media circles? Reboot? Series 2?
Reset?
Reset?
Reinvigorate? Re-something.
Re-something. Let's re-something it.
Yeah.
So, number one. And I think, Rob, this was your idea.
Yeah, so I've become really interested around the subject of distinctiveness and normalisation. Or normalising. You know, how, in all of our programmes and what we do, how do we sort of set ourselves out to be truly distinctive, interesting, unique? And what are the other sort of pressures in terms of normalising and being the same as everyone else? Because I think that's really important.
What are our pressures at the moment? How do you see the pressures?
I think the pressures are around resources, finance, people, and that manifests itself in lots of shared modules across a year group, having more numbers, of greater numbers of people on those modules, move towards fewer assignments. So those are sort of some of the pressures I see. What do you think?
I agree with that set of pressures, and I think the one that really stands out for me, that idea of a greater number of people on particular modules, because that links to one of my personal one of my personal frustrations, which is to do with the split in our timetable at the moment, where we are expected to deliver to a great number of people all in one session, which tends to then change the dynamic in the classroom, seminar room, workshop room, call it what you will, that we might have really enjoyed, I personally really enjoyed, 5+ years ago.
All you're saying is having a lead lecture of about an hour followed by a 2-hour seminar group, which is very common in many universities. I think we've been quite lucky, haven't we?
Yeah, I think it is very common in many universities. What I suppose I'm sort of mindful of, you know, talking about the good old days in a very naive way. But I was very struck when I arrived at the university 8 and a bit years ago now, the focus on small group teaching, the focus on executive style teaching, which I think was a phrase that was posted actually on the Chichester website. I remember looking at that and being struck by that phrase. That idea of executive style teaching has really, I think, gone away over the last 2 years. For all sorts of reasons, and you sort of highlight the great list of pressures. I suppose there's another, it might not be a pressure now, but maybe a kind of catalyst was possibly COVID in all of that.
Yeah.
And we had to shift the shape of things for that reason. So that's sort of a factor that kind of not concerns me. It kind of interests me that we've shifted, and as you say, that idea of the lead lecture, which for us at Chichester seems to be a 1-hour session followed by a 2-hour seminar, and for some very big groups that 2-hour seminar has been split into two groups, although in some cases it hasn't been split, so I don't really quite understand the point of having a lead lecture with the same number of students as you've then got for the seminar a couple of days later.
No, but I think what I think this sort of conversation has really given a good example of what we mean by distinctiveness, you know, that small group work and that normalising effect around economy and resources. And I think it's just panning out, isn't it? We don't quite know where. I mean, my experience on the Senior Leader Programme, you know, we do have a cohort of, you know, latest one is about 20, but we do have them work into small groups in actual learning sets. And I think that's been, I like to think it's been hardwired into the pedagogy, the people like us, the programme, that, you know, it is hardwired into that, you know, how we do things.
Are you quite overt about using the action learning sets and that small group activity for the senior leaders as a point of distinctiveness?
Yes. When you're... Yeah. Absolutely, because it's where the it's the bridge between theories and ideas, practice, what they do in the workplace. That bridge between the two is the action learning set, in order to ask the question, you know, how do I go about doing this in my organisation? What, how do I work through the problems of that? And it's, you know, if you look at the feedback, module evaluation, that opportunity just to work in very small groups on specific workplace issues is seen as being really valuable.
How much do you sort of shout out about it when you're in that pre-signing a student stage? Are you, you know, is it a big headline on marketing material and the sort of website stuff that goes out to employers, or is it much more subtle?
It's probably, I don't sing about it other than in a one-to-one conversation about what's the experience like. So that's a really interesting point about making it more explicit. I mean, that is a tendency of me. I tend to be a little less explicit. And some colleagues find that frustrating. But I think it's a good point.
I suppose I'm reflecting on the fact that in the sort of starting point of the conversation, thinking about distinctiveness and normalisation.
Yeah.
For an idea of distinctiveness to manifest itself, we need to make it explicit.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Tell people, but you know, the other way of looking at it, distinctiveness comes in how it feels and how it affects people and shows up in what they do downstream. But I guess the distinctiveness for me begins when they start the program and it goes sort of goes through, and I think you're pointing to how we make that more widely known, and I think that's a very good point.
I suppose, yeah, like the idea of downstream, I might have got my streams mixed up, but that idea of downstream, so the distinctiveness shows up in terms of the experience for the senior leaders, and I suppose comparing that with the sort of work I'm still doing mainly with undergraduates, with level 6 students and below, trying to still involve opportunities that allow, not our action learning sets, but involve things that are a bit like action learning set and therefore inform a distinctiveness. I think I'm trying to do those things, but I'd rather, like you, I'm kind of conscious of the pressures.
Mm.
I am trying to make that point with some of the students at the moment about the benefits of it.
Yeah.
And I'm consciously trying to make that point because of the change in the timetable pattern.
Mm.
Now, I don't know where that point will end up, but I think if we reflect on the sort of external picture of distinctiveness, if we haven't been talking about how we're distinctive internally, like you already are with students, if we haven't been doing that, we can't go outside and talk about being distinctive. Mm. So I think the way round we have it is right. I think we need to be practicing distinctiveness before then shouting about it, rather than flipping it the other way round, which kind of often makes me think that there is a quite significant weight at the top of the university to drive some kind of normalisation.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think it's interesting, you know, if you look at cultures of organisations, you know, going back decades, and because here at Chichester, you know, immediately, sometime after the war, there was a very sort of well-known principal, wasn't there, Miss Murray, if you came across her. And, you know, there are still colleagues in the university who have family, who still have family, you know, mothers or aunts that were here and remember Miss Murray. And in terms of distinctiveness, post-war, resources were really scarce. But there was a creation of something distinctive here. Mm. So we were in a meeting today. I don't know if you noticed me sort of looking at the walls and the artwork. There's a lovely picture there by Bernard Sturm. I was looking him up on my, covertly looking him up on my phone and becoming really interested in, well, I should have been paying attention to the meeting.
I'm sure you were able to pay attention as well as look someone up.
But Miss Murray had this idea that she would sponsor and purchase small items of sculpture, of art, and be a patron of art. And you can see that on the walls today. And I say that because for her that was an important point of distinction, because it enriched the students. And now she wasn't looking for cause and effect and all the rest of it. For her, it was almost like an item of faith. Mm. But it did create a distinctiveness about what is valued and what is felt as important. And I think we're still benefiting from that today.
That's a really helpful signpost, because I'm often struck by the amount of artwork that's around the walls. And I think it's something that does enrich the space, and that idea of it informing the culture certainly kind of informs the climate in many places. I suppose there's a part of me that worries that kind of distinctiveness, that kind of conversation about how we are distinctive, is at times absent from higher level communications. The people that run the university are not really trying to make those points.
Mm.
And I fear that's where issues will lie, particularly in the future, as you've already highlighted, this kind of very pressurised context of finance, people and resources. I did it in the wrong order, but...
I mean, of course, we see that, you know, across the whole of the university sector at the moment in 2023. But for me, it comes down to a fundamental question. What is it that we want to be known for? What is it that we want to be proud of? And I think this idea of enabling constraints, you know, we always live in a constraint-driven world. Mm. But within that, how does it drive our sort of imagination and ways to think about, you know, literally what it is that we want to be known for? And I don't hear that question here and elsewhere being asked enough, and how it links in with pedagogy and how it links in with societal good.
Mm. Yes, I am deeply troubled by the absence of that conversation. Mm. And I think we both were in part at least involved in a recent top-down communication exercise, really. I don't know what else to call it.
Mm.
from one of our DVCs, Deputy Vice Chancellors, and it wasn't a conversation.
Mm.
My feeling was that there was no invitation to be there was no invitation to take a proactive role in a conversation about distinctiveness. And you know, to pick up on that idea of normalisation, much of that DVC communication exercise was about driving our activities, driving what we do towards some kind of normalised outcome, whether it was REF, TEF, KEF, HIFE, all of those lovely acronyms.
Yeah.
But no doubt are very important and probably are quite high up the to-do list of vice-chancellors and deputy vice-chancellors. But I don't see any kind of acknowledgement of the context for this particular university at Chichester, which is not the same as the universities that you hear often quoted and used as comparators. It really kind of strikes me as very weird that we have a sort of competitor benchmark group of universities, and then other people talk about universities they've worked at. And for some reason, there's this expectation that if you're at Abbott A, we should be able to grow student numbers from 100 to 700 because we should be able to do that.
Yeah. I mean, as you know, after this, after our conversation, I'm going to go to an exam board for a large university. But and in my other external examining roles, I see this played out in a lot of universities, this sort of, it's something around looking externally for validation, whether it be KEF, REF, or any of those other Fs. It's that outsourcing of moral and personal organisational responsibility to what is right outside. And I think it's to do with a lack of confidence and a lack of sort of the confidence about being distinctive. Because there's a shadow side of being distinctive, because what you're saying also is that actually I'm interested in this, but I'm not interested in this. And that, by saying I'm not interested in this, you know, comes with a financial price tag, which some people find concerning.
Yeah, I can absolutely see that. I suppose there is... there's often an opportunity with the shadow side, and I think your point about the confidence is key. If we were confident about the distinctivenesses we have, it almost circles back to that question I asked you earlier about how much shouting about your distinctiveness do you do. If we were more confident, then maybe that should be the starting point for any kind of interaction, any kind of conversation, any kind of team meeting, communication, whatever, and kind of highlight that distinctiveness right at the start, whether you're talking to a group of students, colleagues on the same level as you, or senior management above you. And I suppose I'm immediately struck by wondering where that lack of confidence comes from. What actually is the cause of that lack of confidence?
Yeah, I mean, on the one hand, it's maybe intrinsic and it may be extrinsic. So extrinsic, you know, we're overseen by Ofsted, aren't we, for our apprenticeships. I mean, that's like some Harry Potter monster coming to see us, isn't it, really? You know, a sense of dread that occurs creates a chill in the air. You have Office of Students, we have... all of these other sort of bodies. I mean, no wonder confidence, you know, evaporates so quickly. You know, you've got to have the intrinsic part of us really believing in something. Mm. You know, it's got to be pretty strong in order to combat that.
Sort of outweigh it.
Yeah. But for me, I do have very strong beliefs and... you know, what's actually important pedagogically and the rest of it. But there is an organisational amplification that has to happen for that to, you know, for us all to believe that. And I'm not saying for one moment I am right, but I just believe it in a certain way. And I enjoy conversations around, you know, nature of distinctiveness.
So thinking maybe in terms of more... In line with a kind of art of the possible. Is there, you know, is there a sort of an opportunity to somehow reinforce at a very grassroots level. And if you like, this is a little bit like, you know, undertaking some kind of sort of skunk works initiative, very much at a bottom level or lower level in the organisation, not bottom. Is there an opportunity to sort of tweak things and actually start saying what's distinctive at those grassroots? Let's use the term grassroots. So we've mentioned this idea of sort of talking about, as a more in headline, that opportunity to use action learning sets to make it distinctive in certain programs. What's your sense of other opportunities that we could explore to create at a grassroots level those distinctive moments?
So I think are you advocating for some sort of guerrilla distinctiveness army or movement?
I am increasingly minded that we need to just do things.
Yeah.
And that manifests itself in many ways. But I think that could be a moment where it could be a moment now where we could take an opportunity to start talking about this is what we do, which is distinctive. And maybe some of the things we talked about earlier this morning, so for the benefit of people listening, as a school we're in periodic review period at the moment with a raft of lovely external advisors, external colleagues coming in to look at what we're doing, and maybe some of the discussion we had this morning about what we do on those programmes could be the start of that that creation of a climate of distinctiveness where we start reinforcing those things initially amongst ourselves, then with our students, etc., etc. But I think your example of the action learning in the senior leaders is a good one. So I just wondered what other opportunities there might be.
So yesterday I was up in London with two of the some of the master's students. Oh, hello. yesterday we were I was up in London with some master's students, and we were learning by walking around, and we did a 4 mile walk from Victoria Station to London Bridge, talking about economic clustering in terms of geography and temporal and spatial clustering. You can only do that by walking around. You can only do that by physically seeing it and experiencing it, like walking up to the Royal Courts of Justice. You know, what does that feel like? You know, that sort of the sense of learning in its most holistic way.
Yeah, that's a really good example. So there's obviously opportunities to kind of use that device some more. I think for bigger groups, in terms of practicalities, taking everyone to London might be problematic.
Oh, very.
But actually, walking them down into Chichester city centre and exploring some of the issues, funnily enough, we were talking at lunchtime about the high street and the issues on the high street, actually. So learning by walking around is a good one. We've already touched on the action learning sets. What else do you think drives distinctiveness that we could shout about?
To me, I think it life beyond intended learning outcomes. Anything really. That might be artfulness. It might be painting. It might be, you know, all sorts of things that brings a wider way of knowing, wider ways of knowing the world into our management and leadership practice. So the last few years I've been encouraging students to use Sway in that's a website designed for in its Microsoft application, something that encourages people to be more imaginative, to be able to integrate film, video, pictures into their assignments. Anything really. I think sometimes in assignment briefs or in modules, actually there are little ways to wheedle out little bits of freedom, and to make the most of it without actually then having to go to seek approval for that.
I think the idea of freedom is an interesting one, isn't it? And again, during the periodic review, I was particularly struck by one of the externals raising this question of co-creation.
Yeah.
And I think everyone answered the question really well. And I had, as people were talking about sort of examples of co-creation, I was thinking, oh, again, I could mention this, I could mention that. And in the end, the sort of moment passed. But in many ways, our final modules present an opportunity of co-creation, particularly in the new workplace learning module, where essentially those students have to create their own assessment activity to meet their own SMART objectives.
Yeah.
That's co-creation in the sense. And I suspect that compulsory placement module at level 6 actually is quite distinctive now. I can't think that I've seen many other similar examples of what is effectively a full-time, part-time placement in the final year.
And also it creates the opportunity, there's freedoms within that to be quite very creative, isn't there, in terms of the employer,
yeah,
the student, us as faculty. So that negotiation, three-way negotiation, is a real opportunity.
Mm. I've been trying to think about ideas of encouraging imagination for years now, and I think we've talked before about creativity in other podcasts. One of the things that I'm trying again this year, I have yet to see the results, but I used it last year, is the idea of using a storyboard in a leadership module,
yeah,
to try and work out how students see their own kind of route in life, and particularly working on the idea of what they think their purpose is, what they think their leadership purpose might be. And last year, this time last year, effectively in a small group, admittedly, we were able to run a tiny little exhibition of A3 sheets of storyboard. And the same thing is ongoing this week currently, so I have my fingers crossed about tomorrow's exhibition of storyboards.
Excellent.
We shall see, see what the visuals are as a result of that. But I think that kind of speaks to your kind of question of encouraging imagination and valuing that, really emphasising the value in that kind of use of things that are different and engaging with difference.
Just to finish off, I'm just trying to think of, you know, for people listening to this, what sort of test or what sort of, how could they know about this, you know, in terms of their own situation, about the balance between the distinctiveness and normalisation. And there's something about being in meetings and trying to follow the conversation about what's being talked about most. Is the conversation around how do we make this program or module distinctive and new or whatever distinctive for the participants, or is this conversation around how do we normalize and create sort of sameness and compliance with? Now, it's not to say that this is a binary one way or another. It's not a binary one or the other, but there's an emphasis at play that I've noticed. And I think that's... And, you know, having done the work of just trying to understand where that balance lies, you know, how can one push or create a new type of conversation around, well, for me, distinctiveness?
I think it's a really good point. I suppose that's a way in which each of us can think about where those opportunities are to undertake some kind of guerrilla distinctiveness activity.
Yeah.
And I can imagine finding yourself in a meeting somewhere, listening to the conversation largely around sameness, and trying to have the, and you've already used the word, haven't you, trying to have the confidence to actually challenge that sameness and highlight those things that are distinctive,
yeah,
and really, really emphasise those. with colleagues. That's really, really interesting how it links back to the idea of confidence. Yeah. How confident are we as teachers, lecturers, educators, practitioners in higher education?
Is that a point to leave it?
I think that probably is a point to leave it. Certainly my head hurts. What a good conversation.
And I've got an example to get to.